Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Thanks, MOTAT. It is time for Dear Science, and we've got Marcus Jones in studio. How are you, Marcus?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good. Haven't faced the rain yet, but...
Yeah, it's a little damp out there.
But good. CRISPR babies.
Yeah.
They're not crispy.
In capitals.
Yeah, so the regular listeners will remember that we talked about these a few months ago.
We have talked about it a few times, I think. Yeah. Ellen's mentioned it as well. I'm very interested because it's obviously gene editing.
Yep.
And in the sense that this could be a solution for many diseases.
Potentially, but a very, very controversial.
Very controversial,
and
there's
a minefield of ethical issues. So...
What's the latest?
Well, just a very sort of brief recap. This Chinese scientist got a lot of condemnation after revealing in November that he'd used this. It's a gene editing technology, this CRISPR. C-R-I-S-P-R is an acronym. But CRISPR technology to make the first babies with edited genomes. Okay, these were twins born in November, October last year. And what he tried to do was he edited a particular gene called CCR5, just a gene in their genome, that confers HIV resistance.
Right.
Okay. So what he wanted to do was show that he could make these babies resistant to HIV by using this CRISPR technology.
Which is pretty, incredible if one was to achieve that.
Which is great. But as we talked about before, there are ethical issues.
Totally.
And
we're talking, I guess, unborn babies here. People's lives.
That's right. Well, it turns out, people have taken a look at this gene and taken a look at what actual effects editing the gene would have. And yes, it confers HIV immunity. So CCR5 encodes a protein that allows HIV to enter immune cells. So if you delete that part of the gene, you can disable it, which mimics a naturally occurring mutation that confers resistance to HIV. Okay, so that's fine. But there's also evidence that changing that gene, this gene that protects against HIV infection, people who change that gene, they're 21% more likely to die before the age of 76 than people with at least one working copy of the gene. This is a report in Nature Medicine. Okay? So these are consequences, and the reason for this discrepancy is not known, but the reason for the change isn't known, but these are consequences for editing a gene that is completely different, it affects people's lifespans.
Right. And we're talking, this is a direct link from losing that gene and having the 20% of the possibility of having a lower life or shorter life expectancy.
Well, 21% more likely to die before the age of 76. Now, this is analysis based on genetic and health data from over 400,000 people enrolled in this in a UK. It's called a UK Biobank research project. So this is analyzing a vast amount of data. So it's a statistical analysis of these data.
Yeah.
And they don't have enough data to estimate survival beyond 76.
Right.
But they can say with reasonable certainty that you're changing this gene will shorten your life.
What would they say you'd die from?
Good question, and it's not clear. It's not clear exactly what it is that changing this gene causes people to die from. It's just that people are dying earlier. People who have this gene mutation tend to die earlier. That's the link.
How did they even test that?
It's from this study. People have donated their genetic information. Their lives have been tracked. You know, this is this big 400,000 worth of people.
So this doesn't actually have anything to do with CRISPR people, like people that have been...
No, so there is a natural occurring mutation in this gene.
People have analysed losing the... I see.
Yeah. And so people who have this natural occurring mutation tend to have shorter lifespans. So all mammal genomes contain a version of CCR5. So it suggests that it has an important role in animal biology. And this particular mutation, it's called the Delta 32 mutation, is common in some human populations. So about 11% of the UK population carries the mutation in at least one copy of the CCR5 gene, and the rate is higher in some parts like Scandinavia. But mutations that delete part of a functional gene are rarely so widespread. And the prevalence of this mutation, this Delta 32 mutation, that suggests that at least in some cases, it can confer an evolutionary advantage. But scientists don't really know what that is.
See.
So
okay.
the point is, it's you change one thing and...
There's going to be a myriad of things.
Such a complex system, yeah? And there's a quote here that the scientist... he's saying it's just foolhardy at this point to go ahead start mutating genes in humans. No matter how well intentioned we may be when we design these genetic manipulations, we simply don't know enough to be doing this at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the analogy said, if you want to make a car go faster, you can take the brakes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. The car will go faster. You won't be able to slow down, but you're more likely to hurt yourself.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a complicated thing.
It is.
Yeah.
To our next topic, it's actually the issue here is about a trial that published two different conclusions.
Right, and I actually find this really interesting.
Yeah.
it's not exactly obvious what's going on here, but
it's okay. This is
potentially a good thing.
Okay.
I think. So there's a report in a, I think it's an anesthesiologist.
Anesthesiologist.
So how deeply an anesthetist should sedate an elderly person when they have surgery is a controversial issue, apparently. So because if you give stronger doses, it can be linked with earlier deaths. Okay.
Whoa.
So it's important for us to know what the doses should be and things like that. So there was an article in the British Journal of Anesthesia, that's the word, that investigates and rules out, what the links are between the dose and death. And it said, in the conclusions, it ends up saying, these results are reassuring. So people who are going to read this paper are going to say, I'm going to actually change what I do in my treatment, and this is a reassuring result, and that's what I'm going to do. But then the paper analyzed, another paper in the same journal analyzes the same results and reaches a very different conclusion about the death rates.
Right.
Okay. It says the trial didn't include enough patients to reach their original conclusion, or any conclusion for that matter, on mortality and the dose of anesthetic. So this is the fact that we've got two opposing views here. This is the result of quite an unusual peer review experiment. So normally when you submit an article to a journal, the journal sends it off to two or three or four reviewers who are sort of qualified to read it and understand it, and they say, this is great, or change this, or do that, or whatever. And it goes through a few rounds of review, and then eventually it's published. So it's sort of quite... rigorous, but in this journal, the journal tried to tackle this issue of reproducibility, because you've got two different takes on the same sort of data set here, and so what they did was they took just the data from this paper, and they sent it off to an independent expert. And they said to that independent expert, here's this big load of data.
Mm-hmm.
Please write your own interpretation and analyze it, write your own interpretation of the data, and draw your conclusions of this. Okay.
Wow.
So it's like taking someone's data set and then giving it to someone else to do a sort of an independent analysis of that data set.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's in an effort to improve reproducibility. Efforts to improve reproducibility have focused mainly on, methods and results. Can you make the same thing if you do the same experiment, or can you do the same calculation and get the same number? But this is now focusing more on inferences and conclusions. Can you draw the same conclusions? Can you infer the same
mean, a lot of different people and a lot of different expertise would come to different conclusions.
Right.
It's like
Right, and it's really important because you know the last statement in that first article, these results are reassuring. You read that and think, oh, okay, that's the answer. I'm going to use this information now, where it may not actually be true. Mm, and so it's those sort of inferences and in the conclusions of a paper, how much of a how strongly you can base your conclusions on the data that needs to be sort of checked through.
Nice.
This was intended to address overinterpretation, spin. You know, you put a spin on your conclusion, yeah, on your data, yeah, and subjective bias. And it often, you know, you often see that in academic papers. People, mm-hmm, you know, the academics, even if it's subconscious, they want to prove something to
yes,
be true.
Yes, of course.
And so, you know, they sort of lean towards one side or the other. You know, and it's really difficult if you're just reading the paper. You haven't got the data behind it and everything like that to sort of say, okay, well, actually, he's not right there, or she's not right there. So, I think this is a very, very good thing.
Yes.
Some people aren't so happy about it. Some people think, well, you need to be more rigorous. The peer review system needs to be more rigorous,
more accurate.
But I think this is a tremendous thing, and especially for a field like medicine, where the conclusions drawn in papers can almost immediately affect treatment.
Very true. And people's lives.
There you go.
We're going to quickly touch on this last story. Is that cool? We might have to leave. Anyway, let's talk about the coal. What's happening in the UK?
Sure. So this is I heard this in the news the other day, and I thought it was remarkable. So the UK, and I don't know whether it's still ongoing, but this was as of a day or two ago. The UK was 16 days coal-free. In other words, they hadn't burned a single bit of coal to produce electricity in the last 2 and a bit weeks. Yeah.
Oh, congrats.
That's the first time in 130 years.
Whoa.
That basically since before we started burning coal in power plants, since that the UK has been coal-free for 16 days.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Why do we burn coal? Because I feel is something that we really should not be doing, right?
Well, I think a lot less. I mean, I actually looked up the numbers for New Zealand. And New Zealand, this is Wikipedia. It's for 2014, so I don't know how accurate this is. But New Zealand generation from coal was only 4%. Vast majority is hydro, but 16% gas. Now, it says coal in the UK, but still 40% was produced by burning gas.
Oh.
So this is not eliminating fossil fuels, but it is eliminating a particularly dirty fossil fuel.
Yes.
It was 40% gas, 20% nuclear.
Right.
Okay, so New Zealand obviously doesn't have nuclear at all.
So the highest was still gas? The highest
was still gas, at 39%, 20% nuclear. We've got 13, UK's got 13.5% wind, which compares to only 5% in New Zealand. So I think the UK has invested a lot in wind energy, offshore wind especially. And this is UK, you know, everyone knows. It's not always sunny in Britain, or very rarely. and yet, they've still got 7% solar, as opposed to, New Zealand. Where's solar? Solar's not even on the list.
Oh,
that's awkward.
Hydro, gas, geo.
But
wind,
maybe
coal.
I mean, what? There's 24. I don't know.
It's under other. It must be under other renewable at less than 1%.
Wow.
So New Zealand, come on, you get
Step
more sun than the UK. Oh, you can do better than that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's pretty cool, and it's really accelerating. Apparently, it was only earlier this year they had their first coal-free day.
Right.
And now they've had their first coal-free fortnight.
Over 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
So they must have to just keep going now. I think that they should just keep going.
Absolutely. But more and more renewable, you know, wind is coming online, more and more solar is coming online in the UK, I know that. I mean, obviously, there's a big nuclear portion, and there's obviously big issues related to nuclear. But it's not a fossil; it's not a greenhouse gas emitting generation industry. So, I mean, I think it's a very positive direction.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Are you okay if we wrap up there?
I'm absolutely fine.
All right. Thank you so much, Marcus.
All right.
Mind. blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.